They think we're lazy.
They think we're weak-willed.
They think we're entitled.
They think we're selfish.
They think we don't care about anybody but ourselves.
We are compassionate.
We are resourceful.
We are capable.
We want to make a difference in the world.
We are underestimated.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Underestimated Brandy Peltz. In our last episode, we shifted our focus from Brandy to a possible connection, the case of Darlene Hulse. In similar fashion, we will spend this episode discussing the case of Linda Weldy, another girl whose death is commonly associated with the Peltz's tragedy. Like with Brandy, the decades since Linda's death have allowed rumors to propagate and linger without people giving them much more thought. A similar age and area mean the two must be connected, right? Today, we'll be giving that question a closer look in hopes to further the discussion surrounding these missing girls past the surface-level depth that has persisted for decades. After the death of Brandy Peltz, another girl an hour away in LaPorte, Indiana, was found dead on train tracks near her home. Linda Weldy went missing on February 24, 1987, which was 2 months after the death of Brandy on December 11, 1986. People in the city started to wonder if the two deaths were connected somehow. Because, really, what are the chances of two young girls being murdered an hour away from each other in the span of 2 months? After their passing, people attempted to connect the two in any way they could, so that information could be found that could lead them to any answer surrounding the mystery of their deaths. As time has gone by, people still talk about the two of them together, along with their potential association with the subject of our last episode, Darlene Hulse. But is it for good reason? Linda Weldy was a 10-year-old girl who lived in the city of Kingsbury, Indiana, at 181 West McClung, only an hour away from Argus. The city was small, with only a population of 256 in the year of 1990. The city remains around the same today, with about 180 to 200 people, most likely due to no one really leaving or moving into the city. Even though Linda was a citizen of Kingsbury, she attended Critchfield Elementary as a fourth grade student, due to the school being closer to her home by 15 minutes. These kinds of numbers are pretty standard for small rural areas and can create a closer community for those you know. But due to Kingsbury being so removed from others and it being a rural town, that can also make forming new connections with others a bit harder. This didn't stop Linda from making friends, as she had a close relationship with a girl who lived down the street in the trailer park who she would frequently visit. Though, there was one thing keeping this family isolated: cell phone access. Linda's mother didn't have access to a cell phone while at work, so they had to rely on a CB radio for communication between them while she finally got to her car. This meant that a good amount of the time, nobody was ever really in the know unless a plan was made and stuck to a T. The family itself was complicated, as Linda's biological father wasn't in the picture. This separation left Linda and her older brother, William, with Robert as their stepfather. The home also had seen visits from Mark, Robert's 19-year-old brother. On Tuesday, February 24, 1987, Linda's brother William was in the yard around 3 p.m., helping Robert install a radio antenna for the home to use since immediate phone access outside of the home was limited in the 80s. Then, half an hour later at 3:30, Linda stepped off the school bus as she did most days and walked to the end of her driveway to the mailbox, just like she did every other day. As the bus closed its doors and drove off, that was the last time the other children, the bus driver, and the men working in the auto body shop across the street would see her. Linda had never made it up the 250-yard driveway, where the path wound into the trees, blocking any view that could have created a modicum of safety. Karen, Robert, and William went about their days with no idea that their daughter and sister were missing for hours. When Karen started the drive home from work around 11 p.m., she used the CB radio in her car to contact Robert to see if they needed anything for the home. And that's when the crucial communication breakdown was made known. Robert asked Karen if she had told Linda that she could stay the night at a friend's home, because he hadn't received a call from any of the homes that may have had Linda over. Karen said she hadn't, and that Linda wasn't the kind of girl to just go somewhere without notifying someone. Karen immediately changed her path to the LaPorte Police Department to report her daughter missing, and soon news spread. The local media had picked up the story of the missing girl, and the search for Linda started. The morning of Wednesday, February 25th, the police had sent out people on foot and even a helicopter to search for her, but for weeks, nothing was found. The police investigated the home, and there were no signs of a struggle at all. The mailbox was empty, and there was no mail scattered across the front drive. Even the men who worked at the auto shop heard nothing, which made everything all the stranger. While the police conducted their interviews, a mother spoke up and said that just minutes before Linda had disappeared, she drove to pick up her own child, who was waiting at the bus stop, but it was all a moment too late. Posters were made and word spread for people to keep up the search, but for 3 weeks, there was no news. Then, on March 17th, Linda Weldy's body was found near the train tracks running along US 95. After weeks of cars driving past her body on the tracks, a farmer drove down them to start field prep when he saw her body in the brush. She was found clothed and with signs of strangulation, blades of grass still clutched in her fists.
When horrific tragedies like these happen with no clear evidence as to who or how, people immediately shift their attention on what they can speculate on, and that is often the suspect list. The way Linda was murdered wasn't anything the town had seen much of, if at all. It caused concern, especially due to the death of Brandy Peltz and Darlene Hulse nearby. Finding the suspect became a matter of safety more than curiosity for many. The town was worried that a killer was on the loose, and that was evident later with a suspect Karen Egolf could never really look away from. Larry Hall was a man born in Wabash, Indiana, alongside his twin brother, Gary Hall. Larry wasn't considered the smartest kid in school and was often teased for having lower intelligence than those around him. He would start committing petty crimes in his hometown before he soon picked up an interest in Civil War stories, and when he grew older, he became a reenactor. This passion of his required extensive traveling, meaning he would often have to drive for hours on end and be in multiple states in a short period of time. This hobby of his also required equipment, more specifically, weapons. The earliest his crimes may have started was in 1981, but due to Hall's history of traveling, there may have been many crimes falsely attributed to him just because he was in the area at the given time. As Hall continued his travels, we don't know if he murdered any woman between the time he was active, 1981 to 1994, the year of his arrest. But we do know he was charged and convicted of the kidnapping of 15-year-old Jessica Lynn Roach. Jessica Roach was not only kidnapped but murdered. At the time of Larry Hall's trial, there wasn't enough evidence to say he murdered Roach, but there was enough hard evidence presented to say that he had kidnapped the girl. This conviction landed Hall in prison for life, but the investigation around him only grew as he had other crimes to confess to. Hall had confessed to several other murders, but none of the confessions led to further convictions. This was mainly due to Hall confessing to murders that had nothing to do with him, so it was difficult for law enforcement to be able to discern false confessions from earnest ones. As investigators followed the details Hall provided, they were able to see that he was present in the area of LaPorte during the time Linda had gone missing from her home. This detail has stuck with Karen to this day, but there is nothing concrete to connect Hall to Linda. Most of the victims Hall was accused of murdering were older women and were often stalked beforehand, but not in a way that kept him discreet. Hall usually made his presence known to these women. He would often follow his victims beforehand and offer them rides. The women would then turn down the offer and would subsequently report the suspicious activity to the police. The murders that are often attributed to Hall are the ones where the women were strangled, sexually assaulted post-mortem, and then dismembered. Linda Weldy was only strangled and beaten, and they were unable to determine whether she had been sexually assaulted. From our research, the only reason Linda often gets included in Hall's list of victims is most likely due to the fact that Hall was in the area at the time. Hall wasn't the only suspect, as theories continued to be crafted. The community and Karen Egolf had another man in mind when it came to who could have been responsible for Linda Weldy's death. Eskimo, or Oliver Peak, was a man who belonged to the local chapter of the motorcycle gang, the Sinners. The family got involved with the group when Robert Egolf, Karen's then-boyfriend, started the process of joining. When Robert ultimately turned down the offer and returned the vest, this allegedly caused Peak to harbor bad feelings towards him. Some think that this may have caused Peak to then seek out Robert to confront him, but found Linda returning home from school instead. 2 years after Linda's death, Peak was found dead in his home, and gossip quickly spread through the town about what happened to the man who found himself on many suspects' lists. People whispered to one another that Peak had been killed by other gang members for harming a child, with the child being Linda. However, this rumor was quickly dismissed as his cause of death actually stemmed from health complications. Some people believe that Robert was more directly involved in the case outside of his brief encounter with the Sinners. The police have said many times that it is always someone closer to you than you think in regards to the suspects in Linda Waldie's case. This directly links to their earlier mentions of Robert Egolf, the stepfather of Linda. The only thing people ever accuse Robert of is that he had reported Linda's absence to Karen at 11:30, but this makes sense for several reasons. In the 80s, phone access was not guaranteed, so if Karen had worked somewhere without cell phone access, then there was no way he could have contacted her about the missing girl. Now, Robert had been described as a mean man by one of Linda's friends, but there is no further evidence suggesting that Robert may have been the one responsible for her death. Karen had said that she would have never married him if she was sure that he would have hurt her in any way. There was one more person people look to when considering suspects, Mark Egolf, Robert's 19-year-old brother. The police immediately flagged Mark as a potential suspect when he initially lied about being at Karen's home the day of the murder. Mark had recently been working on his car at Karen's home and left it there the day Linda went missing. He told police that he hadn't been there recently when in reality he had been there a few days before to work on the car. When the police continued their questioning, they brought up grease stains and fibers that were stuck to Linda's jacket. They told Mark that the identified stains and fibers on Linda matched the ones found in his car, but he had told them that Linda and William had been playing in the back of the car while he was working on it. He then explained that the car wasn't even his and he was borrowing it from a girlfriend. As time goes on, investigators still believe that the suspect is someone within the family's inner circle, but as evidence available to the public remains scant, people can only go off of what they have heard or what they may be able to put together on their own.
As people search for answers in Linda's case, her name is often still connected to Brandy Peltz in many published sources. But a lot of the time, it's difficult to find the connection between the two of them. Some things about their cases do align, while others just don't fit together at all. The circumstances of their deaths sound similar on paper, but with careful consideration, the thought that the two are related starts to fall. Brandy was killed inside her home with no signs of forced entry. This already brings up a huge discrepancy. Brandy's killer had felt comfortable entering the home of their victim and had enough information to ensure that the young girl was alone. Linda, on the other hand, was abducted from a driveway outside with no sign of struggle. The killer in Linda's case didn't know enough about the young girl, or didn't have the confidence and knowledge to enter the home. Her killer removed her from the property, at least with the knowledge the school bus would show up, if this wasn't completely opportunistic. The two remain related because Linda and Brandy are both young girls, Linda being 10 and Brandy being 11 at the time of their deaths. Both of the girls had died due to strangulation, but it was never specified as to how Linda was strangled. This isn't just a random detail to overlook because it matters when looking at their circumstances. Usually when more rage is involved, the attacker would use their bare hands. This isn't always the case, but it is common behavior that has been noticed in similar cases. However, this doesn't make the methods incomparable. While both deaths were horrific, it is important to understand that they could have some feasible ties through the methods the perpetrator may have used. The phone cord was missing from the wall inside Brandy's home, and this has led many to attribute the missing object to what caused ligature marks found around her neck. The lack of direct strangulation suggests that either the killer didn't feel like they needed to use their hands, or that at the time of Brandy's death, the killer was unable to use their hands. The person who had killed Brandy effectively used the phone cord to choke her, while Linda's cause of death was most likely manual strangulation. While it isn't fully known if Linda was sexually assaulted, Brandy Peltz was confirmed to have been assaulted at the time of her death. Brandy had also been left unclothed and inside her home, while Linda was taken from her driveway and dropped off at nearby train tracks, still fully clothed. Linda's friend also received many strange phone calls before Linda's death, just like Brandy, but the phone calls Linda's friend received were connected to an upset family member. Both the calls Linda and Brandy received did not go uninvestigated. People often seek out connections for any answer they can get, but the connection between these two cases are very weak. The two girls were similar in age and lived in the same state, but when looking deeper into the details, it is hard to link the two with a common suspect. The waters get muddier when trying to involve Darlene Holtz with the two of them. Darlene was a mother who was murdered in her home with her three children who all went unharmed. The circumstances in Darlene's case are so far off from the two girls that it would be hard to say that the motivations between the homicides were from the same kind of person.
As we close the curtain on this episode, it is important to remember that rumors are just that, conjecture without proof. In this instance, though Linda and Brandy are often spoken of in the same breath, there is no evidence to suggest that these two tragic cases have the same perpetrator. Similarities begin to fade away when closely scrutinized, and what remains is not a shared killer, but a shared impact. Decades later, people are still searching for closure in the cases of Linda Wilde, Darlene Holtz, and Brandy Peltz. Although the series is ending, we hope the search for Brandy's killer will not. As long as her case is still open, we will continue telling her story and remembering her name. We aren't just looking back. We're bringing Brandy's name into the present, in hopes that someone will say something that can finally bring this little girl home. Underestimated Brandy Peltz was researched, written, and produced by Gracie, Lexi, and Jacob. Intro music by Haley, all other music by Shane Yoder. Our show artwork was created by Chelsea, and our series artwork was created by Jacob. The Underestimated podcast is a production created in the Brandywine Community School's Broadcasting CTE program. We want to thank you for listening, and a huge thank you to our community sponsors for supporting us and helping to fund our work. Please make sure to leave us a review on your favorite podcast player, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Underestimated.